This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The president's $396 billion military budget has come under fire from Democrats and policy analysts who have done the math and figure that all that money for bombs will leave precious little for butter. Scholars at a recent forum hosted by the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation in Washington addressed the economic and social cost of pouring millions into a war to attack Iraq.
I have a little theory, and it came out of the Vietnam War, which says that Americans have become so affluent that we don't have the stomach for a long war anymore. We want to enjoy our yachts, and we want to be out on the golf course. We really don't want to think about a long war. And so I believe that one of the reasons why so many people have found ways to insulate themselves from military involvement and are comfortable sort of making the decisions to send other people off to war is that they don't have a personal investment in it. It's the same question about who needs government. One of the reasons why the conservatives are able to make many of these decisions that they're able to make is because a lot of them don't need government anymore. But for those of us who need government, it seems to me that's the group that has the most investment in these kind of decisions that we're discussing here tonight.
Dr. Ron Walters, a professor at the University of Maryland.
What we haven't looked at in terms of this administration are the least and the left out. And so we need to be clear about what the notion of a nation is, what we mean when we talk about America. We need to reject a rhetoric that talks about a clean skies initiative that will cause more pollution than we have ever seen in life. We need to look at all the rhetoric that is being used, and what the rhetoric is hiding is the fact that monies are being put to the top and not to the bottom, and that war will exacerbate all of this. What is most frightening to me about the State of the Union address is that the issue of cost was never addressed, is that we have not talked about the cost of war. The question is it worth it? Saddam Hussein has been crazy all his life. You know, I mean, we're clear about that. He has never had good sense. So why have we suddenly decided to pull the plug on his idiocy? I mean, clearly, he is not an imminent threat, as Congresswoman Jackson Lee said, not an imminent threat as much as North Korea is. Do we need to spend billions or trillions of dollars to stop folks who literally become an imminent threat when we threaten them?
Economist, social critic, Dr. Julian Malvo.
How will low-income and minority communities be affected? Should increased domestic terrorism become the result from a war on Iraq?
I would just remind the audience that five people died here in Washington as a result of some anthrax that got distributed. And we don't know who did it, but I'm confident that it is a function of an effort to terrorize. And every time I get on a plane or go abroad, I carry a sign. I'm African-American, y'all. I'm African-American because I think, as in most things, we do half the living and twice the dying. We get, and that has to do with income. We get half of that. We get the least education to make money, the least health care to live long enough to enjoy it, the least quality of housing, and the least justice when half the people in jail are people of African descent. So we have a big stake in this process, and I am hopeful that people of African descent around this country will give Martin Luther King Jr. a birthday present on January the 15th, 2004, and go to the polls and vote as never before, so that those who sit down to consider these policies on these committees that decide who's going to get the tax break and who's not will know that we are clear and that we're determined that we are going to take care of the least of the
Reverend Dr. Walter Fauntroy.
I've been a pastor for 44 years. The first 10 of those were with Dr. King trying to do the street thing to affect public policy, and the second 20 in the Congress. And quite frankly, I want to see this government work in self-defense, because if my neighbors don't have any income, guess whose income they're coming for? If they don't have any quality education, guess whose schools they're going to ruin? If they don't have health care, who's going to get TB? Because it does, you know, it's an equal opportunity destroyer. If they don't have housing, whose house they're going to break into? If they don't have justice, who's going to reap the result of the anger that is the result? So let us get involved as never before and think these three things through and interact on the kind of wisdom that has been poured out here today.
Well, that is certainly correct, but I want to take a somewhat different tack, and that is that when the U.S. does this war, terrorist acts in the United States will increase. They will increase from abroad.
Dr. William Ellis.
But they will also increase in the United States. It takes a couple for those in the United States, it takes a couple of steps to get there. Take Timothy McVeigh. Oof. Timothy McVeigh was a terrorist. He killed a couple hundred people. He blew up a federal building, and they fried him for it. Now, he believed that he was disinherited. The reason that he believed he was disinherited is because of the vast inequity of distribution of all the things that Reverend Fauntroy talked about in the United States. To the extent that the war sucks a whole bunch of money out of the system and exacerbates the social inequalities in that system, social strife will increase.
Yes.
And the McVeighs will increase because it will fall not just on us, but it will fall upon white poor folk in general. Now, you ask, well, people used to ask me, well, how many of these militias are there, for example? Well, I say, well, 15,000 to 100,000, depending upon who you ask. But not all of them are terrorists or potential terrorists. But then the numbers are not of any importance, because it only took from 2 to 6 people to do that Oklahoma City thing. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? So the greater the social inequalities, the more U.S.-based terrorism we're going to get right here, and the more the war has progressed in the Middle East, the more terrorism we're going to get from overseas. That will affect us all, but it will fall most harshly, as everything else does in America, on those of limited means, especially African Americans.
Dr. William Ellis is a specialist in domestic terrorism and information technology at the Congressional Research Center in Washington, D.C. The African Union, a body of 53 member states whose mission is to foster prosperity, peace, and democracy on the war-torn continent, has joined the ranks of the European Union in opposing the U.S.'s unilateral approach to disarming Iraq. The African Union met yesterday and issued a declaration today against war in Iraq. In it, African countries urged the U.S. to work with the U.N. Security Council to bring about a peaceful resolution. South African President Thabo Mbeki is president of the African Union, and along with former President Nelson Mandela, has taken a lead role internationally in the growing movement of countries opposing a war in Iraq. Peace Watch correspondent Hannah Lewis has more in this report.
As head of both the African Union and the non-aligned movement of countries, South Africa sees itself as having a moral obligation to try to prevent a war in Iraq. The non-aligned movement was established during the Cold War as an alliance of countries opposed to nuclear proliferation, Western colonization, and foreign military installations. It is the largest single political grouping at the United Nations. South Africa also prides itself on having voluntarily destroyed its own nuclear weapons arsenal a decade ago, and to the satisfaction of UN weapons inspectors. That history gives South Africa a rare moral authority in urging other nations to follow suit. Within days, South Africa will be sending an envoy led by Deputy Foreign Minister Aziz Pahad to Iraq in hopes of personally entreating Saddam Hussein to cooperate with UN weapons inspectors. But South Africa's leaders have insisted that the United States must cooperate too. In a scathing speech former President Nelson Mandela gave in Johannesburg last week, he accused President Bush, along with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, of undermining the United Nations.
What I'm condemning is that one power with a president who has no foresight, who cannot think properly, is now wanting to plunge the world into a Holocaust.
Nelson Mandela, South Africa's first majority elected president and former African National Congress leader who brought down apartheid, commands respect and admiration worldwide. His statements on controversial issues in South Africa and throughout the world are not easily ignored. Although the Bush administration was quick to rebuke Mandela's recent criticism of the U.S. president. Within South Africa, however, Mandela's statements against war do not fall on deaf ears. The overwhelming majority of members of parliament from 13 parties agree that a war in Iraq without unequivocal United Nations approval and support should be prevented. This is according to parliament member Farouk Kasim of the Inkatha Freedom Party, who reported that Parliament debated this issue last November before breaking for winter recess.
The viewpoint was also that if a war did break out in the Middle East or in Iraq, there would be an implosion in the Middle East. And that would then very, very quickly have repercussions on the African continent and on the African countries. We don't see ourselves as far removed from the theater of war. And if the war were to break out there, there would be serious economic and other social consequences for our country too. So it's not like this is a war in a distant place that would have no ramifications. In fact, the ramifications could be so many and so varied that not even those who have the wisdom of Solomon would be able to determine what would be the fallout from such a war. And when we consider that already we are talking about a clash of civilizations, and that if the war then becomes a further milestone in this war of civilizations, then the question of terrorism worldwide would increase many folds. So although a battle might have been won, or two battles might have been won, the war itself could in the end be lost. And we would like to, and I think the viewpoint of all of the parties here was for a cool, calm and considered approach to be taken to the problems. I don't think that anyone supports what is going on in Iraq. I don't think there's anyone who believes that the building up of weapons of mass destruction is something that can be supported. Of course we don't. I think we're all clear on that. But the remedy that is to be used must not be one that is worse than the problem itself. Because if that compounds the problem, makes that problem more severe, then what would have been solved in the end?
The opinions heard in the halls of government are echoed on the streets. Along a busy commercial stretch of Kloof Street in downtown Cape Town last November, a random sample of people responded to the question of a potential U.S.-Iraqi war with resounding disgust.
I'm totally against it because I know maybe Saddam Hussein is not the saint, but I'm more concerned about the children and the Iraqi people, I would say. So it's the children that's going to suffer. So having children of my own, I would say, yeah, the children, for the future, for the country. You've seen what they have done to Afghanistan. I mean, so that will happen to Iraq. Not that we don't know that they've been bombing Iraq for the last 10 years, you know, silently. So what can I say?
We here, like in South Africa, we've been through a lot and we've discovered, like, talking things over is the only way. So I don't think if they could go there and fight and it's going to solve anything. It's never going to solve anything.
Well, obviously, I think it's wrong. I think it's got a lot to do with the government forcing the people to, well, making the people feel that's the only way, like they're trapped if they don't do it, like it's the only choice to make. And I don't think American government stands to gain something from attacking them. I don't know whether it's got to, it must be to do with money or power, but I think the American public are being scared into believing that war is the only answer for them to protect their safety. So I think, yeah, it's basically a bunch of bureaucrats forcing innocent people to die through their own fear.
I think before he goes in and causes more, what's the term, collateral damage, I think he's going to need some really, really, if he wants, I think his ratings will go up anyway, but if he wants the world's ratings of his policy to go up, I think he's going to need some really strong evidence. I think he's going to need a team of inspectors to go in and say, we've just found 10 warheads stuck underneath Hussein's bed, basically.
My opinion, it's actually very anti-American. That's how I feel. I think America is spreading propaganda, making the Muslim people what they are not supposed to. And that's actually my opinion.
What do you mean when you say anti-American?
America, my opinion is the way I see it, because I watch CNN every single, okay, not every single night, but as often as possible, and they just showing the, it's not actually America invading Iraq. That's not the issue the way I see it. It's just that they don't like Muslims. That's the way I see it. Any Muslim country, and I think America's got some share in whatever Arab they after the oil. That's the way I see it.
The sense that U.S. foreign policy unfairly targets Muslims is shared within South Africa's sizable Muslim community. Mulana Ihsan Hendricks, the deputy president of the Muslim Judicial Council in the Western Cape, explained that his organization has voiced serious humanitarian concerns for the suffering of Iraqi people to the South African government. He said the government has been receptive.
We believe that the larger, innocent population of Iraq needs to be considered, and it is our wish that the United States of America and the United Nations find a solution, a political solution, rather than the option of a military attack, against Iraq. Part of the principle, integral principles of Islam, is that each individual and every human being has the right to peace and justice.
As Washington seems to draw ever nearer to war, South Africa leads the international scramble to avert it, either through the non-aligned movement's influence at the United Nations or by getting the message of total compliance through to Iraq. For Peace Watch, I'm Hannah Lewis.
And finally, Peace Watch producer Armando Houdinho of KPFK shares his musical montage of voices of resistance from the L.A. area.
Iraq doesn't pose a threat to the United States, doesn't pose a threat to the international community or to its neighbors, especially in terms of weapons of mass destruction. Iraq is a has basically had a law passed that declares it to be a threat without the threat actually really being there. The point should be, is there a case for war against Iraq? Does Iraq truly represent a threat to international peace and security that warrants war? I mean, was this a just application of the law, or was this something different? And I think if you study the record of history in regards to why we pushed the Security Council to pass this resolution in 1991 calling for Iraq's disarmament, you'll find that it didn't come from any real sense that Iraq posed a threat. Iraq had just been destroyed, handed a decisive defeat in the Gulf War. The fourth largest army in the world had been decisively, destroyed on the field of battle. This was more about finding a diplomatic and political vehicle for the containment of Saddam Hussein, using weapons inspections as justification for the continuation of economic sanctions that contained Saddam. And I think that, one of the things we're confronted with is this concept of an Iraqi threat that's based upon, not a very sound, foundation of data. Iraq doesn't pose a threat to the United States, doesn't pose a threat to the international community or to its neighbors, especially in terms of weapons of mass destruction. Iraq is a has basically had a law passed that declares it to be a threat without the threat actually really being there.
Well, I think the mainstream media has not done enough to challenge the administration on its logic. For example, they had two arguments. You know, one argument was that Saddam Hussein was somehow connected with September 11th, which is quite obviously untrue. The second one is this whole logic that if he possesses nuclear weapons or chemical weapons, then he will give it to terrorists who will then use it against us or our enemies. Now, we know that Saddam Hussein has had chemical weapons for over 20 years. He used them in the Iran-Iraq war. He used them against the Kurds. But he never gave it to anybody. He could have given it to Hezbollah, who could have used it against Israel. He could have given it to Al-Qaeda, who could have used it on September 11th. So the logic that if he has chemical and weapons of mass destruction, he will use it via terrorism is untrue. So the question then begins to understand that why do we need to go into Iraq? And these are some very serious questions. What is the grand strategy?
On Iraq, the council will also talk about a possible ban on decloying registered voters.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our names.
And citizens voted for members of Cuba's municipal assemblies.
Not in our name will you wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless.
Just call 1-800.
Not in our names will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real.
We rely very heavily on a limited number of critical infrastructure, few key industrial systems like telecommunications, the internet, the energy complex, chemical facilities, which are often closely located with population centers. So that turns us, our country, into a quite difficult set of targets to defend against this adversary we face. The important thing to understand about this adversary and about terrorism in general is it's not an ism, it's not an abstract concept out there. It is real people, individuals whom we often know their identities, know their general appearance, and they are strategic actors. Right? They attack us at the time and place and the method of their choosing, not ours. And they hit us where they know us to be vulnerable.
The age of white supremacy is gone. If you have a child, teach that child more than one language. If you have a child and then they're in the United States, teach them to speak Spanish. Think about the future, and the future means not English only. It means being bilingual.
How in
squirrel.
And camping out with Camp David. Who's sleeping at the Bush's weekend getaway? We have the list, the friends, the family, and of course, those campaign contributors. Don't go away. Good evening. Our top story tonight, the showdown with Saddam.
Well, Andrea, it's often been said that in times of crisis, American presidents always ask, where are the aircraft carriers? Well, over the weekend, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld signed out deployment orders to send two additional carrier battle groups, the Theodore Roosevelt and the Abraham Lincoln, to the Persian Gulf region. Now, that when they arrive in about 3 weeks, that will bring to a total of four aircraft carrier battle groups within striking distance of Iraq. And we're told there could be at least one more, the Kitty Hawk, out of the Pacific to head to the region before the president would make any possible decision. Begin with you. You have put out this ad, and here's what the ad, among the things you say in the ad, you say that the left has a war against America. You say they believe it's America, not Hussein, who is evil. They think America is the great Satan. And then you go on to talk about how this was done under the auspices of the Communist Workers World Party, meaning the march in Washington last Saturday, which to me is red-baiting. You are trying to define the left a certain way, David, and that's just not the way it is. At least be honest about what the objectives are here. People there on Saturday. I don't think they're all followers of the Communist Manifesto or Maoists. While there may be some of those people who did participate, what's your response to what David here is saying, Kevin?
Well, I think Mr. Horowitz must be threatened by the incredible growth of the peace and justice movement, not only in this country, but also around the world.
Put your hands together one time. I want you to get together.
Thanks to Peace Watch producer Armando Gudinho of KPFK in Los Angeles for that creative expression of anti-war sentiments. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Keith Xiaojian, Reem Kathuta, and Benta Berklin. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge to our secure online website. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.